Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined today by Hale. This is a sort of part two to an episode that we did previously where we discussed it's not even really a chapter, it's like a small section from a book, The Philosophy of Death by Stephen Looper. In that text, he gives an exposition of what he calls positive hedonism, or I suppose what we could just call hedonism. Being an ethical framework that couches welfare or the good in terms of pleasure and pains. So for a positive hedonist, what is intrinsically good is pleasure, and what is intrinsically bad is pain. Anything that's instrumentally good gets you to pleasure, and anything that's instrumentally bad deprives you of that pleasure or gives you pain as well. So in that episode too, this is more or less just a recap of what we were going on for listeners who may not have heard that, or just to get the ball rolling on this episode, because we'll be talking a bit more about the second half of this and going into a bit more text as well. Stephen Looper brings up three possible thought experiments to try and problematize the idea of hedonism, that there might be something more to the good or to what we value than just pleasure. And these are the first one is Thomas Nagel's The Contented Infantile Man, and the other two are by Robert Nozick, The Deceived Man and The Experience Machine. Very briefly, because we'll be talking about Feldman's attempt to address these specifically, but the contented infantile man essentially is that while you're sleeping, someone pours a potion into your ear that turns you into a contented infantile. You experience pleasure for the rest of your life, but all of your cognitive abilities have, when we would think that there's something wrong here, that a person has been harmed.
And with all of these three examples that Looper used, and we talked about last week, obviously, the idea is that if you become the contented infantile man, well, you're going to live a highly pleasurable existence after being basically made. All of these really present the reader with basically a trade-off. Like, it's basically displays, you know, in these sorts of situations, would you take living a life that seems great to you in some specific kind of way, and I guess we'll talk about that, in exchange for, you know, with the contented infantile man, like in exchange for your like mental fortitude and ability in this case, right? And all of these have these sort of like trade-off options. And I think the initial reaction to them is to usually say, no, it's not worth it, right? Like it's not worth it. Therefore, hedonism's not like a viable philosophical program. I did want to say one other thing just with the intro of hedonism for our listeners, which is, again, we're talking about, since this is, we're doing obviously an ethics episode, this is kind of like an obvious ethical system. If you're advocating for hedonism, you're not stating that hedonism is not necessarily reflective of how people factually live their lives, right? And I'm sure we'll get into that more. We talked about it last week. There's a lot of ways in which one could say, oh, okay, well, some form of hedonism, or there's, I think we'll eventually get into kind of a consequentialism, utilitarian thing. Like, that's actually how a lot of people think and act. This is more a discussion of, like, whether or not this is actually a viable moral system. Like, just because there are some people who live this lifestyle doesn't necessarily mean that we should live this lifestyle. Or maybe we should. Maybe people don't. But actually, in fact, the hedonists are right, and it is what we should be doing.
Yeah. You're obviously kind of going into this distinction between a description and a prescription, right? That there are people who do, we all do kind of gravitate towards pleasure, and we shrink away from pain. So it's descriptively true in some sense, but how far people take it as a sort of intentional ethical system, I would actually be, uh, I I as far as people who do intentionally take it to be like an ethical system, there may be people who do take this. There might be other ways of framing the good. But again, this is kind of distinct from the question of, should we take this position? Should we frame the good in terms of pleasures or pains and whatnot? Independent of the fact that not only do people intentionally do this, but even unconsciously, we seem to gravitate towards pleasures and pains as well. I think your point about the purpose of these experiments as well is, I think you could even put it more strongly that they are intuitive pictures. They're supposed to be intuitively evocative of showing that if we say that the good is pleasure, these seem to present problematic cases, right? Where people are either will refuse to take up these sort of situations or these circumstances, such as the contented infantile man. I think it's even more significant though, and almost, it's not, I don't know if it's more damning, but it is very significant that the fact that these present alternatives that we genuinely have to weigh and contemplate. Like, if there is something very intuitively appealing about the idea that what is good, the ultimate good, is pleasure, and if that seems true, the fact that there's this situation where we even hesitate at all, well, independent, like, some people might take it, but the fact that we have to hesitate at all and sort of weigh it out and think about it, that is that is in itself a significant concession against hedonism. So that's just the first of this image, though, that the first of these thought experiments. There's two others. The deceived man is this idea that a person lives a happy and honest life, and one that is full of pleasures, not just physical pleasures, but even specifically relational pleasures, such as belonging to a family and they're flourishing and they're all happy and healthy. But the thing about this thought experiment is that while the person who is in this family seems to be flourishing in their relationships with everyone, with their children and with their spouse, really, behind closed doors, everyone hates them. at least the way that the relationship appears is really not the case, right? So it's this idea of living a life, but it's somehow that's the thing, is it doesn't actually show in this person's life. All of the experiences that they have within these relationships are on the face of it genuine. They go through and have the same pleasures and the same experiences as someone who is engaged in a genuine and on both sides authentic relationship. But behind their back, there is a kind of deception. That's why Nozick calls this the deceived man. He's deceived in the relationships that he has, and they're not authentic in that sense. And this image of a person kind of going through this like Truman Show-like experience really does unsettle us. Like, even if we give in and say that, yes, they're having all of these pleasurable, even intellectually pleasurable or relationally pleasurable experiences, there's still something deficient about this particular picture, right? And again, the purpose of these thought experiments is to show that, well, if pleasure was all there was, this would be a perfectly legitimate situation. But clearly our intuitions are kind of, our intuitions run up against a wall with this. There's something about truth or genuineness, a groundedness to the appearances, that we do really value. The third one is probably the most famous of these three, and it's the thought experiment, the experience machine. It's quite short, so I'll just read it. Suppose there were an experience machine that would give you any experience you desired. Super duper neuropsychologists could stimulate your brain so that you would think and feel you were writing a great novel or making a friend or reading an interesting book. All the time you would be floating in a tank with electrodes attached to your brain. This one is maximally pleasurable. You literally can have any kind of experience at all, even one that's not possible, say, on Earth or in any kind of historical, within any kind of like historical constraints or anything you could imagine. If you can imagine it, you can have it. Yet this one seems to be the most, at least to my intuitions, I'm wondering this about you. This one is the most sort of jarring. It's the one that seems the most unsettling, like, you know, getting into this pod and never being able to get out and knowing that, and not knowing that you're in it.
Yeah, it's the Matrix
right, yeah,
kind of problem. I mean, that's literally, I'm sure the Matrix was borrowed largely from thought experiments like this. I think it's the most jarring because it's the most, like, unreal, right? Like, you've got one where your cognitive functions are, like our first one, the contented infantile man, you've got a situation where someone is actually dumbed down, but still living in the real world. They're just experiencing it like a happy child, basically. Then you've got a world where someone is living in, again, in the real world, but it's everyone is lying to them, but they're real lies, for lack of a better way of saying it. I think the machine, the mind in the vat, or the Matrix problem, whatever, is the most jarring because it is the one that puts the subject in the most fictional or the most unreal situation, right? Like, they're literally in a, you know, what if you want to call it, computer or whatever created world, and there is no, like, it's not even that their world is, like, people are lying to them or there's some sort of conspiracy or they're just dumb. It's that they're literally interacting with a, like, program that they don't know is a program, and they don't exist in the real world and all this kind of stuff. And so I think it's the most jarring, but I also think it's, like, the most reflective and in some ways the most flexible, because you could say, like, well, here is this totally created world for the hedonist, for example. You could say this world is perfect, right? Like, because it's completely engineered, it is totally, totally perfect. It's everything you would ever want it to be, and then some. So I also think in some ways it presents, like, the most convincing argument. I was going to leave this a little bit later, but I'll jump into it here as we kind of talk about hedonism a little bit more and different options. And one thing that comes to my mind when we start talking about, you know, hedonism really as a potential, like a real potential for an ethical theory, is that there's something about it that seems to be a little bit like, I wrote on my notepad here, our listeners can't see my notepad, but what I wrote is opting out. And what I mean by that is there's a kind of, all hedonism, and maybe it's because these experiments have a little bit of this engineer too, but there seems to be a little bit of a, well, you know, if I just, like, I can sort of negate everything else that seems important or that I might be concerned with and just focus on pleasure, right? Like, I can kind of opt out of all the other concerns or potential responsibilities or duties or whatever that we might have as individuals, we might feel imposed on us, and just kind of go full for pleasure. I think that's most reflected, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, in some examples of what we might call hedonist, like, super lifestyle. You know, the example that comes to me most obviously would be, like, you know, someone in the midst of like, just constant, something like constant narcotic use or whatever, right? Like, but there does seem to be this kind of, like, oh, like, if the world is just about pleasure, if I'm committing to hedonism, then I'm opting out of all my other sort of connections to the world. And this doesn't seem to be, like, a great, like, it always seems like a very uncomfortable truth to me within the context of hedonism, but it does seem to be something that at least I kind of read into to taking that step.
That's really, actually, that is really interesting. That's something that I've thought about this a little bit in terms of one of the things that I've encountered when kind of nosing through and like misunderstanding and not getting psychoanalysis at all is this idea of, because I like reading, I don't really understand him, but I like reading Winnicott. With Winnicott, he has this distinction between a true self and a false self. And we use this term, the true self, nowadays, thinking that there is this like inner truth that we have. And if we could just find ourselves and we could actualize or self-actualize or whatever, which is like a Jungian idea. If we could just be our true selves, then we would be happy.
The past cultural sort of modality or like theme was like sincerity. So this is like we're talking basically up until like the current kind of modern era, especially with, you know, looking at Western society and things like the kind of medieval, but especially the early modern, you think about these sincerity is the idea that you're born into and have a role that is kind of like, it just is what it is. And you live that out in a sincere and honest way. Like you're not trying to figure out who you are. You're born into, you know, the cobbler's family, or you're born into, you know, the nobility, or you're born into, you know, a family of sailors and that kind of world and the certain habits. Then, you know, you, as you and I have talked, and I'm sure our listeners might be familiar with, like, you know, the term authenticity comes in, where it becomes this more, okay, like I need to make a decision about who I am as a person. But I also think that authenticity, as we're kind of, I think we're talking about here, or that kind of search, that kind of being like, I'm an individual in the world and I get to make choices that kind of are determined the sort of person that I am, and, you know, the sort of self-discovery. I'm not going to let society impose stuff on me. But it does also open up, I think, the potential for hedonism as a actual lifestyle or philosophical system a little bit more, because now people can kind of say, though, that is the life, like, basically, like, pleasure is what I want to pursue, right? Like, I'm not being imposed in any kind of way to go this way or that way. I'm going to just, like, you know. And I think you see this a little bit like in current culture, like I'm just like living to have a good, you know, here. Yeah. What's the song? Here for a good time, not a long time.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, right?
Yeah. It is interesting, especially that kind of, I'm trying to bring this to like an, not like a contradiction, but there seems to be two things going on that we would use by the same name, something like true self or spontaneity or authenticity or whatever like that. But I think it goes back to what you were talking about originally, which is this idea of like opting out, right? So Winnicott's distinction between a true self and a false self, a true self now is understood as like, oh, I have this inner subjective truth, I just have to actualize it, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not really what Winnicott meant when he talked about a true self. When he talks about a true self, he really means like you being in this mode of being where you have the capacity to surprise yourself. You can't anticipate who you are or what you're going to do in any given moment. You're acting spontaneously, and that means that you don't know, right? You're in a mode where you just dredge up whatever is spontaneously activating in that moment. A false self is someone who knows ahead of time who they are. They have all these ideas and they have these self-conceptions and stuff like that. I think that's the paradox of what becomes of this idea of a true self. It's like, I know who I am. Okay, well, you can't really be what Winnicott would call a true self if you know who you are, right? And this, I bring this back, or go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I actually really think this is a great thing about doing shows like this for our listeners and for us. I think this is a really interesting tangent I wasn't expecting, but I think that it's very reflective of what we're talking about here in the context of hedonism. And I think if we're going in the same direction, it's very revealing of something that I think is wrong with hedonism, which is that it is not, hedonism, for all its, you know, investment in something like fun and pleasure and all this kind of stuff, lacks flexibility, it lacks spontaneity, because it's a very, like, determinative kind of like philosophical or ethical system, because you basically, the point is always like you know where the point is going all the time, right? Like I don't have, if I'm a fully committed hedonist, I'm always pleasure seeking, I'm always out there doing this thing. Obviously it's a caricature, but like we'll use it for the sake of the argument. You know, there's actually not, as much as I might do a bunch of crazy stuff,